Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare science at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, Christmas in July. Well, almost. Then we premiere our special segment on caregiver journey. But first, name this classic story.
You are about to show me shadows of the things that have not happened but will happen. Is that so, Spirit? Ghost of the future, I fear you more than any specter I have seen. But I know your purpose is to do me good. I am prepared to bear you company. Lead on.
If you said A Christmas Carol from Charles Dickens, you hit the nail on the head so hard, it's now a permanent fixture. That version we played is from Disney's animated interpretation with Jim Carrey. I absolutely love this story, and there isn't a film or stage production of it that I don't enjoy. Now, everyone knows how Ebenezer Scrooge is haunted by three ghosts, each representing and presenting versions of the past, present, or future of his life, which ultimately leads to Mr. Scrooge's conversion from a miserable miser to a good humanitarian because he can see what could happen to him if he continues in his current ways. In healthcare, there is a version of those three Christmas ghosts that has the same power of conversion. I'm talking about genes and genomics. Individuals who know about it, if they possess certain genes, act as they have been shown their past, present, and potential future based on that knowledge. Think of the BRCA1 genes in breast cancer or the APOE4 genes in Alzheimer's. Thanks to companies like 23andMe and many more, many folks are armed with their ghosts of Christmas future information. So today we bring an early holiday to you and talk about genomics to better understand what it tells us and, more importantly, how you can use that information for your greater good. To paraphrase Little Tim in that show, God bless us all, indeed. Joining us is Dr. Elizabeth Reed Aden. She holds a PhD in biomedical anthropology and conducted her postdoctoral studies in human genetics at Stanford. As senior vice president of global pharmaceutical strategy at Roche, headquarters in Basel, Switzerland, she participated in all product-based decisions. She is currently serving on a board of director of pharmaceutical company and just recently released a mystery novel that pertains to this topic as well. Dr. Aden, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We love having you here, and we're going to get right into this. So can you explain to our listeners out there, what is genomic data, and why is it important for all of us, the public, listeners, to understand it?
So genomic data pertains to your genes. And it turns out that there is a Goldilocks effect, meaning too little, too much, or just right, a Goldilocks effect between your genes and your prescription drugs, or at least 80% of your prescription drugs. And what we're talking about here is there are two types of genomic data. The first type, which is the most complete, is something called a whole genome scan. And that's where they look at everything that's part of your DNA. And this is comprehensive. It covers insertions, deletions, multiple mutations in the same gene. Now that gets really, really complicated. But it turns out there's a shortcut. And that shortcut is called a single nucleotide polymorphism.
Oh, well, that's a mouthful. Can you explain
that? Isn't that a mouthful?
Can you explain that to all of us?
I can, but we're going to abbreviate that to a SNP.
Okay.
And that's exactly what it is. It's like a SNP of your gene. It's a SNP where there's a change in one base pair in that DNA sequence. So it's not the whole gene. It's a SNP of that gene. So there's just one change. And those SNPs are the quick and easy way, if you will, of finding out if you, your prescription drugs, and your genes have where you are in the Goldilocks spectrum. Is your prescription drug just right for your genes? Is it too little? In other words, you're not getting the effect that you expected.
Right.
Or is it too much and you're getting side effects that you can't tolerate? And as a result, you go back to your physician and you say, can we change this medicine? So your genes or your SNPs is a way to take our current approach to prescription medicine, which is one size fits all until it doesn't. And then we'll try another size and another size. So it's a shortcut to getting the right drug first time.
I love that. And I listen to this and I'd say, my goodness, that would be revolutionary in the sense that that would kind of shut tons of follow-up visits to people like me.
So, for example, then you could actually spend more time with your patient. Just saying.
I love the idea. How accessible is this type of genomic data to people like you and me?
There are two steps to this. So first of all, it's very accessible through 23andMe, MyHeritage, Ancestry.com. If you wait for the sales, costs about $99 to spit in a tube and send it off, wait, and you get your data back. But what they send you back are things kind of innocuous, your traits. What's your likelihood of developing atrial fibrillation? And most of these look just very kind of boring, a little bit interesting, unless you're like 10 times more likely to have some problem.
Right.
But most of it's just kind of interesting. But what they don't really show you is what is the raw data. So when 23andMe first came out, they gave you everything, all your drug gene interactions.
Yes.
And then the FDA stepped in and said, you don't have approval to do that. So that prompted me to go and figure out how to get that information for my brother, because he spit in the tube after the FDA stepped in. And it turns out that there are a lot of third-party sites that will upload your basic data, which 23andMe, Ancestry, MyHeritage, all give you, but they don't really make it easy for you to find that data.
Sure.
But it's all there and it's in a text file. And the text file can easily go into an Excel spreadsheet, or can be readily uploaded into third-party providers like Prometheus or CodeGen, which then takes all that data, and then you can interrogate it and say, oh, well, what gene do I have for what genes process Lipitor?
Yeah.
What genes process Prozac? What genes process carbamazepine? And then see where you and your genes and your prescription medicines are. And the easiest way to find out if your prescription medicine is one of the 80% that is metabolized is go to the part of the drug that you probably never read, which is the drug interaction section.
Right.
That comes in that piece of paper that you usually throw out.
Which is, I might add, like 1,500 to 2,000 words long of listings.
In teeny tiny type.
Correct.
So you need a magnifying glass to read it. So you look for things that have the initials CYP or HLA.
Okay.
And those are, so the cytochrome P450 are the CYPs or the CYPs. And these are the enzymes that are in your liver and they are taken advantage of by the medicines to process.
Understood.
And remember, most of our medicines originally began as plants.
Right.
And so we take the pharma has taken the active ingredient from those plants and they're processed through your liver. So why do we have so much variability in these enzymes? Well, it turns out that there's an adaptation that our livers have made through these enzymes to our diets. So the diets in Asia are different from the diets in Australia,
right,
that are different from the diets in Europe, South America, etc. So there's been some selective pressure on how we metabolize our food or plants in our environment to get rid of some of the toxins that might be part of those plants. And that's where all these different variations of these liver enzymes comes from.
I see. It's like that's because if we're used to a certain diet, that's our bodies are used to processing it. So whatever you've done with your food is how you're going to process medications.
Exactly.
Dr. Aden, I want to get to this part. One of the things that you kind of helped to espouse is that there are steps to knowing your genomic data, and you've just given us some, but what are those kind of, like, in a brief manner, those steps that we need to kind of know our data so we can use it for ourselves?
Okay. The first step is to find where your raw data is if you do one of these genomic testing services. And usually it's hidden in your account information. And they'll say, oh, raw data. So you download that. And it's good to have regardless. And for information, in general, everybody tends to use the same testing service. And I think most of them use Illumina.
Okay.
So you download it. And then you go to one of these sites, Promethese or CodeGen. And Promethese, it's $12 for access to your data for 6 weeks. So let's take that as the example. It uploads your data, and then it spits out all these reports that you can then download and go through at your leisure.
Okay.
And CodeGen does the same thing, and it's a little bit more accessible, but what it doesn't let you do is download it. You can print it, but not download your report.
Okay.
So you get your results. So let's take an example. In my case, I put together a how-to booklet that's available on my website.
Okay.
And I said, you know, 30% of Americans have a lifetime probability of being on an antidepressant. And 20% of all drugs are metabolized through cytochrome 2D6. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, what's my genotype for 2D6? So I then said, all right, I get my number and it says, oh, I am CYP2C6*39. Well, what does that really mean? So then I went to the website Snippedia. It's like Wikipedia, but
for genes.
SNPs, yep. For genes, for those single nucleotide polymorphisms, those SNPs.
I love this.
And it gives all of the SNPs that have been studied for that particular gene. It tells you whether it metabolizes Prozac, whether it metabolizes Prozac normally, abnormally, too much, too little, or just right.
Wow.
And it's a really good starting point to at least begin the discussion with your physician.
Dr. Aiden, hold it there. I want to kind of remind folks that they're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJZT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about how to use your own genomic data. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. Dr. Aiden, please continue.
So it gives you a starting point. So, for example, the one gene, so what I did was I took the genes that Vanderbilt University, their medical center, has identified the top 10 genes that have drug-person interactions, drug-gene interactions. And then in this, my how-to book called Drugs and Genes, which is a free download on my website, ElizabethReedAiden.com, I looked at my genes, and then I found one of them, I might have an issue with in the future. So if someone were to prescribe warfarin for me. Which is a blood thinner. Then I might not process it quite normally. So that's something that I should be talking about with my physician. Now, most likely, the physician would want to confirm it.
Right.
But oftentimes they don't. They just say, we'll try it and see what happens.
No, that is the natural answer. So, Dr. Aina, as I listen to this, I realize it strikes me that everyone should have this. you know, when I'm listening to this, it sounds like this should be like the fundamental of your medical chart is, you know, I have these genes, meaning these are the ways I'm going to might respond to XYZ drug.
Well, to use the vernacular, duh.
Fair enough.
So the leading institution in this country has been Vanderbilt Medical Center, and they have genotyped all of their patients for 10 genes. Is that enough? No. The simplest thing to do is to put, if you will, your 23andMe data, your genetic data into every medical record. Clinicians are really good at diagnosing what the disease is, but nothing personal. They're not so good on pharmacology and not so well trained on genetics.
No question. let me ask you this. So I'm hearing all of this and I'm hearing these companies. So 23andMe, Ancestry.com, and then there's these sub pieces. The big concern I would have, and others sometimes say to me privately, is that's a lot of private data that is going to this company. That's all about me. What about the privacy or even ethics of it?
So, you know, I've thought about that and I've seen a lot of information about it. Well, first of all, there are laws on the books that you cannot use genetic data against a person. And that's been out there since the whole genome was sequenced. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think the risk, the reward outweighs the risk. So what is somebody really going to do with my data? I mean, seriously, they're going to sort through and find I'm one of 350 million people that have you know, something unique, something different.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I'm not really sure how this gets weaponized. I mean, I can see how it does. I guess I wrote a book about how it could be in a medical thriller.
You did have a mystery, so you do know how this could get weaponized.
Well, yeah, in a sense, yeah. but in reality, I think once you, if there are biobanks that are anonymized, and your medical record is, my vision is this would be part of your medical record. It would be subject to the same HIPAA constraints, but it's a natural place where AI could intervene. And once the physician says, oh, you need an antidepressant, then enters it into the computer. The computer accesses your data, your medical record with your genetic data, and says, oh, well, you can't really use Prozac, but we're going to put you on Lexapro because that fits better with your genomic profile.
You are painting a beautiful picture of a future. I want, in our final moments, give you the opportunity to answer a quick question before we finish, which is, first of all, can you tell our listeners how to get that how-to book on your website? And number two, can you tell us also the name of your mystery book as well before we finish up our conversation today?
Sure. The how-to book is on my website, Elizabeth Reed, that's R-E-E-D, Aiden, A-D-E-N, ElizabethReedAiden.com. It requires subscription to my email, or your email to my website, and the download is free. And it's called Drugs, Goldilocks, Drugs, and Genes. And my medical thriller is The Goldilocks Genome. And it uses the antidepressants as the example of the Goldilocks effect between you and your drugs.
I love this. And thank you. You've just given me my next beach read down here in Florida, because now I'm looking forward to kind of checking that out. Dr. Reed, I want to thank you so very much for joining us today. This is fascinating. I could spend hours, because this is, and we'd love to have you back to talk some more about it. But we really appreciate you joining us today and explaining all of this.
Well, thank you. And anytime, I'd love to come back. It was fun.
That was absolutely a joy. We've been talking to Dr. Elizabeth Reed Aiden. She is a former executive with Roche. She sits on board of directors of pharmaceutical companies and is an author as well. And she's been guiding us on how to best use our own genomic data. Up next, we'll be right back after our weekly health headlines. Send it out an SOS. Send it out an SOS. I'm sending 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 out an SOS. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist and professor of healthcare administration and policy. This is What's Health Got to Do with It. These are your weekly health headlines. Florida allows C-sections outside the hospital amid safety concerns. Florida becomes the first state to permit C-sections outside hospitals, aiming to reduce costs and provide a homier birthing atmosphere. However, experts warn that this move could increase risks during emergencies. High maternal mortality rates persist in the American South. The American South continues to struggle with alarmingly high maternal mortality rates, with Arkansas leading at 43.5 deaths per 100,000 live births, four times higher than the state of California. While South Carolina saw a 16% drop in pregnancy-related mortality among white patients, rates increased for black women, exacerbating racial disparities. the FDA reviews a new once-weekly insulin, yet has concerns over safety. The FDA is reviewing a new once-weekly insulin product titled Awiqli by Novo Nordisk, which shows a higher risk of the side effect of low blood sugar in type 1 diabetes patients. Despite the proposed use of continuous glucose monitors to mitigate risks, the lack of clinical data on this strategy has raised concerns. Baltimore faces unprecedented overdose death rates. Baltimore is now the U.S. overdose capital, with nearly 6,000 deaths in the past 6 years. The city's overdose death rate is almost double that of any other major city, driven by fentanyl and shifting priorities in addiction response. Guardant Health's blood-based colon cancer test nears FDA approval. An FDA advisory panel recommends approving Guardant Health's blood-based colon cancer test, Shield. FDA approval could lead to broader adoption and potential Medicare coverage, which is crucial for the test market's success. AI breakthrough, bilingual brain implant for a stroke survivor. Researchers have developed an AI-powered brain implant that enables a stroke survivor to communicate in both Spanish and English. This innovation represents a significant advancement in brain-computer interface technology. Girls in the United States are starting their periods younger, and irregular cycles are now more common. A new study finds that girls in the United States are starting menstruation at younger age, particularly among racial and ethnic minorities, with many experiencing irregular cycles linked to various health effects. Lastly, high dropout rates for weight loss drugs like Ozempic. A study revealed that nearly 60% of Americans on weight loss drugs such as Ozempic quit before achieving significant health benefits. Side effects like nausea and vomiting are common, raising questions about the cost-benefit balance of these treatments. And those are your weekly health headlines. You know, one of the most common and impactful healthcare trends in the United States isn't occurring in hospitals or clinics. It's actually caregiving. And sadly, no one is immune. Caregiving in America is on the rise. Broadly speaking, 100 million U.S. adults function as caregivers, providing care for a child, a parent, or other relative. More narrowly, there are 53 million U.S. adults who care for a spouse, elderly parent, or relative, or special needs child. That's up from 43.5 million in 2015 and includes caregivers who also work full-time jobs. These often ignored caregivers aren't board certified, are not compensated, and are often women. The number of people in the adult population providing care and working outside the household has increased from 1 in 7 in 2020 to 1 in 5 today. And the average time devoted to giving personal care to another has nearly tripled since 2020. Now, I know fully well what home caregiving looks like, having lived through it as a child with my mother caring for my grandmother, to my watching my sister care for our mother and father in later years from afar. So today, we at this show want to help. We are starting a special segment on caregiver journeys, which are often overlooked at best, ignored at worst. Our goal is to share stories from the front line in caregiving so that we focus on the solutions and not the problems. Joining us for our first story is Ms. Sheila Collins from Scottsdale, Arizona, who is a caregiver for her 97-year-old mother. Her mom still lives in her own home less than a mile away, yet her mom requires 24/7 care and it takes two paid caregivers and Sheila and her sister to cover those hours. We're going to talk to her about the details, but she's working about 35 plus hours a week. And Sheila joins us now from her home in Scottsdale and on an extra note on her birthday. So happy birthday, Sheila. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much.
Sheila, can you share with us a little bit about your journey, your experiences as a caregiver for your mom?
Yes. For about the last 10 years, my sisters, I'm one of four, two of us live here in Scottsdale, very near my mom, two live in the Chicago area. We provided some level of caregiving for my mom as she hit her mid-80s. But just about 3 years ago, she had a heart attack. Mm. And from that point on, required 24/7 care. And that was really the pivot point for us. We made a decision as a family of daughters that she would stay in her own home. But that required a total shift in our ability to provide care. And so we found one wonderful caregiver. We found out she had a wonderful caregiver sister. We've hired them both. And then my sister and I take up the rest, which, as you have noted, ranges from 35 hours on the lesser side per week up to 60 hours per week of caregiving. It's changed my life.
Let me ask you this, Sheila. So there was four sisters, and I know this conversation well from a personal standpoint. How did that conversation look in terms of how it landed for you and your sister to be kind of more the direct one, caregivers, I'm assuming, or are all four caregivers just taking turns? How did you figure out the roles in terms of who would get the lead and who wouldn't?
Well, I consider us very fortunate because all of us are in it. I know many friends who there's one person who takes the burden and perhaps the other one sort of ignore it off to the side.
Right.
But in our case, we're all involved and do as much as we can. My two sisters who live in Chicago, they each come out one weekend a month, one long weekend a month, 4 days. And to provide a little bit of respite for my sister Kathleen and I, who live here in Scottsdale. So we're all in. We take different roles. I'm the money person, for example. Another person is the medicine and physician contact. Another one deals with other facets of mom's care. So we're all in it, and we're fortunate that there's four of us who are committed to the same goal of keeping her safe and happy.
That is fantastic. Give a sense to our listeners out there. Paint, if you can, Sheila, a typical day. What does that look like?
Well, first of all, mom is fairly cognitively intact. I think that makes a big difference.
Okay.
Obviously, if she had dementia, we might be having a different conversation.
Okay.
But she is getting increasingly forgetful, as would not be unexpected at the age of 97. She is totally helpless. On December 24th, Christmas Eve, she had a fall. After that, she was never able to walk again. So she's in a hospital bed in the family room. We provide all personal care from changing diapers to brushing her teeth to feeding her. And it is, as I've thought to myself, it's an honor and a privilege, but it's also frustrating and exhausting.
Okay. When you come in, are you the one on when it's your turn and it's up to you? Are you the one there at night, or the caregivers there at night versus the daytime?
Well, I used to be there at night. I used to do three nights a week. But then I had, and I think this is a fairly common story, I had two injuries trying to lift her.
Oh, wow.
I'm 72 years old, trying to take care of a 97-year-old. as my doctor put it, Sheila, you're fairly old and you're trying to take care of the extremely old. I said, thank you, doctor. But it was good advice. And I realized that something had to give, that I could no longer do the nights. So my 35 to 60 hours a week at the current time is all days.
Sheila, you just made a remark a moment ago when you were describing the whole picture for us, that that life has changed. And my question to that is, how has your life changed? I know some of it is somewhat obvious, but give us a sense.
Yeah. You know, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I was a single working mom, and this is way harder. In a sense, my retirement dreams and activities have been put on hold because my main responsibility now is taking care of my mom. I also work part-time as a consultant. I try to fit that in around the edges, although obviously there's limitations. So that's one part of my life that's changed. My mom is not aware of this, but she also ran out of money a year ago.
Oh, dear.
And so my sisters and I fully support her and the caregivers. And in reality, that has also drained each of our savings and or opportunities to spend money on things that we or our families might like. So it has changed in a very real way the way I live my life. Again, I'm not in any way saying that's not how it should be.
Right.
But it is a limitation, and it has consequences.
Let me ask you, if you don't mind, what was it that drained the account? Is it the price of caregiving? Is it medical bills? Whatever you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, it certainly. My father died when my mother was 52.
Okay.
That is 45 years ago. And so the money my dad left for her lasted a very long time.
Yeah.
But not long enough, as we would never have thought. She with parents who were both deceased in their 50s, we never would have thought that she would have lived to 97. Much of what did drain the remaining funds was the cost of caregiving. We pay, I think, a relatively reasonable salary, but it is probably in excess of $70,000 to $80,000 a year for her caregivers, and her expenses in all, totaling her house payments and she's mortgage free, but you know, the utility bills, etc., are somewhere between $120,000 and $140,000 a year. And my sisters and I are now responsible for that.
Oh, wow. When I hear those numbers, those are pretty significant, but I also suspect somewhat typical.
I would think so. Although in many cases, you know, one must think of the decision that we made several years ago not to put mom in a home or in a facility. Would it be less expensive? Perhaps, but the cost of facilities that would be appropriate for somebody needing her level of care is not that different from what we're paying. So the cost of caregiving is a reality and an issue, I'm sure, for many of your listeners.
So Sheila, I guess I'm going to ask this question. I was going to say, what's the biggest challenge you faced as a caregiver? I'm assuming financial comes up there, but I don't want to answer that question for you.
You know, the biggest challenge, Dr. Servin, is, I think, the emotional challenges. It's hard sometimes not to feel resentful. It's hard not to feel impatient. It's hard not to feel, I wish I had more freedom. And that comes with a very complicated array of emotions, because then I feel guilty. And even though I love my mom tremendously and I wouldn't make the situation different, but it is a situation where I have to give myself grace. I remember going to my Catholic priest not too long ago, and at yearly confession, and I talked to him about how badly I felt when perhaps I was impatient with my mom, or I was frustrated, or even resentful. And he said, "But you keep showing up, don't you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he says, "And there's where the grace lies." And so I try to remember that I try to give myself some grace when I have this array of emotions.
Let me follow that up. Since that emotional piece is one of the biggest challenges, how do you prioritize self-care? Knowing that you need it, but I hear you loud and clear. There may be, just for whatever reason, guilt that pops up if you're taking care of yourself, but you need to do it. How do you do it?
It's not easy. It's definitely not easy. But what I've learned is, you know, it's not that different than when we all had little babies and the lesson everyone told you was sleep, or when the baby sleeps, don't clean the house.
Right.
Well, it's the same thing. So when another sister is taking care of mom or a caregiver is, I try to do something that feels good for me. I get monthly pedicures, for example. I try to make sure that I use that time well to call a friend for lunch. Something to fill my bucket as well. And that really is important for all caregivers. I'm lucky that I have some respite. This is not a full 24/7 job for me. And I know for some of your listeners, that may be the case. But the advice is, when you aren't providing caregiving, fill your own bucket too.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about caregivers' journeys. If you or someone you know would like to share your caregiver story, please contact me at health@wjct.org. And if you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. Sheila, what resources or support networks have you found particularly helpful for you and your family?
Well, recently, in the last 4 or 5 months, we contacted hospice, and that has been a helpful service to us. Although she's been on hospice, and although she's very frail, she has no disease process. Her blood pressure is better than any of my sisters or I's. We hope she can stay on hospice because they provide some help with supplies. A nurse comes every 2 weeks just to check vitals, make sure, particularly now that she's consigned to a hospital bed, that there aren't bed sores. And there is a social worker that also comes periodically to make sure that she and we can avail ourselves of any appropriate services. So I really encourage people to reach out. There are community resources, both medical and social. And I think, although my sisters and I provide our own little caregiver support group with the four of us, I would think that any caregiver support groups within the community might also be a helpful resource.
Sheila, one of the things I remember with my own family, because I also come from a large family, is that we all weren't always on the same page. How do you communicate effectively with your sisters and other family members or siblings about whatever's going on?
You know, we burn up the text lines, that's for sure. we've had about every 3 months, we have a sister's video call where we sort of say, here's the situation. What's going on? How's the money lasting? What's the next phase? Because we've seen her care needs increase over these past 3 years, obviously, to the situation she's in now. My sisters and I are very close, but it has not been without some level of conflict and challenges. You know, those of us who are here sometimes feel like we're doing more than our share. Those who are in Chicago feel, I think, guilty that they can't be here more, one of whom is still working full time. And obviously that's a constraint. But we work hard to make our relationship also an important one, because it can be very transactional. Okay, who's covering this week? Okay, has the check come yet? Have you transferred money into mom's account? I need to pay the caregiver. And we have to realize that we're sisters, we're family members, and above all, mom would hate for us to be in conflict regarding her care or herself.
Sheila, have there been any unexpected rewards or positive aspects of this experience that...
Absolutely, Dr. Thurman. You know, mom, as I said, is cognitively intact, although forgetful. But the best moments, and ones that I encourage frequently, when you're there for 6 and 7 hours at a time, it's for her to talk about her past. And I've learned things about mom's childhood and about her parents, who I never got to meet because they were long deceased before I was born. And she enjoyed talking about the past much more than she does about the future. And frankly, is much more in tune with that. So it is a gift to be able to encourage stories from mom, to hear about the things that made her happy when she was a child. And it's amazing the power of memory. The things she remembers from 1935 is astounding, when sometimes she can't remember if she ate dinner or not. And so I think that's a reward, is the ability to learn more about mom in days gone past.
What support or changes do you think you wish you had at a societal level to better support you and your family around your mom?
Well, I think there's there's probably a long conversation that could be had about national policy for caregivers. Respite care, I think, should be something that is baked into national policy and provided free of charge. We're lucky. My sisters and I are lucky that we have some level of resources to be able to provide this really good level of care for mom, but not everybody does. And I think that is something that needs to be addressed on a societal level, that caregiving, as we live longer and longer, is going to become a part of many people's lives. This will be an identity that they take on probably much later in their life than they ever expected. And they need support. They need financial support, they need emotional support, and they need logistical support.
Sheila, in our last question, I wonder if you wouldn't mind providing any advice to those who are listening to the show today, to listening to our conversation, who may just be starting out in this experience themselves. What's your best advice that you wish maybe someone would have given you?
I think the best advice that I could give would be to give yourself grace. You're not going to be perfect at this. The person who you love and for whom you provide care may not like everything you're doing. You may snap, you may answer quickly, you may express frustration. It's no use feeling bad about that. It's just comes with the territory. You're doing the best you can. You're showing up. You're going to get points in heaven for this, I believe. but most of all, you are doing the best job you can, even though it may not be a perfect job. And you just have to give yourself some grace and realize that you are an imperfect person in a challenging situation, and you're doing the best you can.
Sheila, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy calendar after listening to it to talk to us and our listeners. I wish you and your sisters Godspeed.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Sheila Collins, who is a caregiver for her mom, and we are starting our caregiver journeys. If you or someone you know would like to share your caregiver story, please contact me at health@wjct.org. And that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Jamie Belay is our associate producer. Next week's program is our special Father's Day show. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X or LinkedIn at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch. If you're mad, get mad. Don't hold it all inside. Come on and talk to me now. Hey, what do you got to hide? I get angry too. Well, I'm alive.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.